Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're talking about Islam with Dr. Alvin Schmidt this evening. Trying to get at the true nature of this religion. It's rather a complicated subject, and all we've been able to touch upon, really, is just the very, very basics. We invite your questions and your comments. Something we have yet to discuss, feel free to bring it up. 1-800-730-2727. Now, you'll be getting a busy signal, but keep on trying. You should be able to slide in there. We start freeing up those phone lines in just a moment when we take your calls. 1-800-730-2727. Our Issues Etc. forum is up and running at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You'll find the forum there, and we'll get to those questions as time permits a little later in this hour as well. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville. He's author of the new book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. We'll be giving that book away to the best callers during this hour. Let's go straight back to the phones. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back.
Mike is calling from Nebraska. Mike, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello.
Hello.
What I would like to do is try to ask you to answer a question for a Muslim. Okay, and I realize that that may be a little difficult, but if they accept Christ or Jesus as a prophet, and he quoted scripture that was written, among others, by Moses, who they also accept, in the very opening verses of Genesis, or the Torah, we have God making a statement about, let us make man in our image. I'm satisfied it was not referring to the angels, but more to the Holy Trinity. How, if they accept what Moses said to be the truth, what do they say about this reference to our more than one image?
Mike, it's a great question. Dr. Schmidt, they do hold Moses in high regard.
Mm-hmm.
How do they take those opening words, let us make man in our image?
I don't know of any specific reference in the Quran or all the hadith that addresses that particular question, but most likely they would not take it too seriously, because Muslims do say, and I don't mean the average Muslim, but in the official writings, that the scriptures, both the Old and New Testament, have been corrupted.
Now, I've often heard, and this has been said by both Muslim and Christian alike, that Muslims regard both Jews and Christians as, quote-unquote, people of the book.
That's right.
When they say that, what do Muslims mean?
Well, basically that they are the ones who followed the scriptures, the Bible, the Old and New Testament. Yes, that's an old phrase that goes way back to basically Muhammad's day.
And do they mean that they take the Old Testament and the New Testament to be inspired and infallible revelations of
God?
Well,
that's how they would see, for the most part, the Christians and the Jews, how they view the Old Testament. But there are plenty of references, and I cite some in the book, to show how they argue that the scriptures are or have been corrupted over the years, and they cannot really believe. And so one has to believe what Muhammad said, if and when and where he addressed that particular question. But he didn't address that specific question, so I don't know what they would say.
William listens in Sacramento, California. William, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yeah, hi. Glad to be on the show. I have a brother that's a devout Muslim, and my sister is too Muslim. I've been between two of them. It's the most ludicrous, outrageous, ridiculous stuff I've ever heard in my life. This cat is talking about violence in the Muslim religion. What about violence in our own religion, Christianity? I mean, you sit here and you rant, you rave about the sword is the symbol of... the biggest thing in the Christian faith is the crucifixion of Christ. What is more violent than that?
That's an excellent question, William. Let's see if we can put some context on that.
Right.
I'm glad he mentioned the cross, because there's no doubt that the cross has to stand in terms of human history as one of the most violent acts ever recorded in ancient history. But for the Christian, what does that violent act mean, as opposed to, say, the sword that Muhammad claimed to live by?
And secondly, the Christians did not create the cross to nail Christ on it. It was a pagan Roman form of execution. So it's hard to make an analogy here with the Muslim use of the sword and the Christian cross. One was done to annihilate, destroy Christ and Christianity, whereas the other one was done, the sword is used to advance the cause of Muslim ventures as it has done for 1,400 years. And, you know, on the topic of violence, let me just read from a Muslim who lives in Canada. She wrote a book a year ago this past fall, in the fall of 2003. It's called The Trouble with Islam. Her name is Irshad Manji. Here's a quote from her book. She says, quote, "Pick a Muslim country, any Muslim country, and the most brutal humiliation will grab you by the vitals. In Pakistan, an average of two women every day die from honor killings, often with Allah's name on the lips of the murderers. In Mali and Mauritania, little boys are seduced into slavery by Muslim hustlers. In Sudan, slavery happens at the hands of Islamic militias. In Yemen and Jordan, Christian humanitarian workers have been shot point blank. In Bangladesh, artists who advocate for the rights of religious minorities have been locked up or driven out of the country altogether." And then she says, it's all documented. She's right. And by the way, she now has to live in Toronto with bulletproof windows and a guard. Is that a religion of peace?
William, stay on the line. I'm going to send you a copy of Dr. Schmidt's book called The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, so that you can see exactly what the documentation does say about the nature of this religion. Jason listens in Maryland. Jason, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Doctor. I thank you for your work. It's desperately needed, and I would like to read your book. My question is, since God, in his infinite wisdom, decided not to leave the door open to middle ground, Christ cannot be called a great teacher if he's not who he said he is. He can't be called a prophet if he's not who he said he is. He's either who he said he is, or he's a liar or insane. Those are the only three options. I believe he's who he said he was. I'm a born-again Christian. I'm wondering where the Muslim gets their dogma on the Lord Jesus. I mean, they obviously don't believe the Gospels, the Epistles, or the Old Testament accounts about him. So where do they get their beliefs about him? Where do they come from?
It's a good question, Jason. Now, first of all, I mean, it is important to note here, Dr. Schmidt, that it's untenable to hold that he's a good teacher and then say, but what he said about himself was lies. I mean, Jason's point has to be reiterated here.
You're quite right. I mean, Jason is basically saying what C.S. Lewis said in his book, Mere Christianity. He said, a man who claims to be or have been God either was God or he was the biggest liar that walked the face of the earth, and I'm paraphrasing C.S. Lewis. And that's quite right. You can't have it both ways, to say that Jesus was a great teacher, but he wasn't God. He was what he said he was, or he was the very opposite of a great teacher. Great teachers don't say, I am God. What we would say, they are people, the least we would say, they're insane. Well, so we have a choice with Jesus, either believe that he was what he said, I and the Father are one, or as he told Philip, he who has seen me has seen the Father. In other words, he and God, he was God, or he was the biggest charlatan ever walked the face of this earth.
Then with less than 2 minutes, Doctor, before this break, an answer to his question about where does the teaching about Jesus Christ that the Muslims hold to be true, where do they get this?
Basically from the Quran, and the Quran was supposedly inspired, given to Muhammad via the words of the angel Gabriel.
Jason, we will be sending you a copy of the book. If you are still on the line, stay on the line or call us back. 1-800-730-2727. I'll send you a copy of the book, The Great Divide by Dr. Alvin Schmidt, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. You're still getting a busy signal. Please keep trying. Let's take another call here and get the answer on the other side of the break. This time, Dan, calling from Santa Rosa, California. Hi, Dan.
An opening note, not all Muslims read the Quran, but I'm wondering, as I should have spoken up before about this, why is it the people who promote the separation of church and state and other libertarian ideas are the best defenders of these people who don't believe in such things? And Christians who, you know, can see the flaws in Islam are not as loyal to defend Muslim ideas as libertarians.
Dan, thank you very much. We'll get a response to Dan's question on the other side of the break. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We're talking about Islam. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville. He's author of the new book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. You can find out more about this book at Amazon.com. That's Amazon.com. Our forum is at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and you'll find the Issues Etc. forum. It has been down for some weeks. It is back up, and we'll be taking questions and comments from the Issues Etc. forum when we come back from this break, as well as more of your phone calls. Stay with us.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Promise Keepers, Way Down Workshop, The Prayer of Jabez, The Purpose-Driven Life. Why are so many Christians caught up with the latest crazes to hit the church? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article in the next edition of the Issues Etc. Journal titled The Fad-Driven Church. Has the church's quest for relevance made it irrelevant in the 21st century? Find out with the next Issues Etc. Journal. 1-800-737-0172. Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Stephen Hine has also written an article on the Christian life titled Getting Clear on Sanctification. 1-800-737-0172. And the next issue also contains Uwe Simonetto's story From Hedonism to Lutheranism. 1-800-737-0172. Or write Issues Etc. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. The Issues Etc. Journal. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We're talking about Islam. A caller before the break, Dr. Schmidt, had two questions. First of all, he asked why it is that those who would ardently defend the separation of church and state seem to be the biggest defenders of Islam, especially here in the West. And then he also asked about the failure on the part of the same people to defend Christianity. Your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, that's at best, and most charitably, a horribly big inconsistency. When, for example, people who believe in the separation of church and state then unwittingly promote a religion that would undercut that very belief that they hold to. And whether they do it ignorantly or knowingly, I do not know. But every time it happens, you cannot say but. It's a major inconsistency. What was the other question now again?
Well, what about the failure? It seems as though, and you've mentioned this many times in the conversation so far, kind of the lopsided criticism of Christianity, both present and historically, whereas, people hear a program like this and they say, you know, we just don't hear this elsewhere spoken in such clear and unequivocal terms when we speak the truth about Islam.
Yes, well, in other words, you're saying, why are so many people who are, in a sense, putting the best face on Islam, putting a very negative face on Christianity,
precisely,
right?
Yeah.
Well, right. Well, over the years, particularly in the last couple of decades or so, there has been a growing, increasing anti-religious feeling in our country. There's a tremendous irony regarding this. In my previous book that I published 3 years ago called Under the Influence of Christianity, Transformed Civilization, I addressed that in this manner, for example. The very freedom that Christianity has given to the West, such as freedom of speech, separation of church and state, enables these people to criticize the giver of this gift, namely Christianity. And why do they do it? Well, there are many reasons, to be sure. One of them is because, as Jesus said himself way back in the New Testament days, they will, speaking to his followers, they will hate you because they first hated me. One might even draw an analogy, for example, of, I hate to do this, but it, I think, somewhat makes the point of a spoiled child who grew up, for example, in a home where he or she had everything. And so frequently, as happens, we know this even back in the 60s with the flower children, they rebelled. They rebelled against all the goodness that they received. And in a sense, this is analogous, I think, to many in our society. They rebel against Christianity for all the goodness that it has given them by means of freedom and liberty and the like. For example, it's not just these people who defend the Muslim faith as a Muslim religion, by the way, as a result of, in spite of the fact they deny the separation of church and state. The same is true with regard to women. We live in a day and age where feminine rights are advocated, and at the same time, no place in this earth are women more oppressed and subjugated and seen as second-class, third-class citizens, if I may use that word, as they are in Islamic countries. There you have another major contradiction. And it's ignored for the most part. Oh, once in a while you'll see a woman in veiled form on television and the like. But this is what this Irshad Manji is writing about. She's a woman. She still claims to be Muslim. But she says, or there's a woman, for example, in Morocco, by the name of Mernissi, who has said very similar things, pointed out how women are greatly oppressed. And I might cite, for example, the former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Ali Bhutto, who once said, "I know of no religion that oppresses people more than mine." And so all I can say is these people are horribly inconsistent, and unfortunately so. I think there's no other answer there.
Ron is on the line. Thank you for waiting, Ron. He calls from Texas. Ron, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, gentlemen. Dr. Smith, these people who claim to be Muslims that don't hold true to the Quran, would you say that they've made up their own religion, and what repercussions would they face from true Muslim believers?
That's a very good question, Ron.
In a Muslim country, you know very well what they would receive. They would, for example, be imprisoned and probably in many instances receive the death sentence. One only needs to read the Sharia, how apostasy that is falling from the Muslim religion, what it calls for. At the same time, for example, we have to remember that many people who left Islam, even in the Western world, are now living under pseudonyms, hiding their identity. One of them is, for example, Salman Rushdie, who in 1989 wrote the Satanic Verses. To this day, this man lives, for example, under a pseudonym, and I don't know how many people know where he lives, because Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa for any Muslim to kill him. That fatwa, in essence, still stands. And so he's not the only one. There is a person by the name of Ibn Warraq, W-A-R-R-A-Q. Why I'm not a Muslim, once was a Muslim. This man, too, his name Warraq, is a pseudonym. And I cite a number of others in the book. So there you have the example. If Islam is a peaceful religion, why do these people have to take pseudonyms? Why do they have to, for example, live in guarded houses and have police protection in many instances? I think the answer is pretty much self-explanatory.
Now, I guess this raises a question. I asked this of your mutual friend and colleague, Dr. John Warraq Montgomery, several weeks ago when I talked to him. If you look at Islam and divide it into what people call radical Islam, and you make the case that that's true Islam, and liberalized Islam, the kind of Islam we find in the Western world, generally that tries to portray Islam as a religion of peace. If you take these two factions of Islam as generally as possible, which one do you believe is on the rise? Which one do you believe is on the wane?
Well, the true believers, the one who really hold to the Quran, there's no evidence that the others are on the rise. I can't find it. If they were on the rise, I think they would be more vocal in speaking out against what has happened since 9/11 and elsewhere. As I said before, the sounds of silence are sort of deafening. We don't hear much of anything. And why don't we? Oh, I suppose there are a number of answers. One is they themselves would not be well received in other Muslim circles. They would call upon themselves perhaps even worse, perhaps physical danger, even in this country. So they keep quiet.
Someone says, and we have a minute here before the break, someone says, look, I can walk into a mosque on Friday and I can hear the local Muslim preacher preaching, and it sounds very peaceful. It sounds very conciliatory. Sounds as tolerant and as open-minded as anything you might hear from any kind of generic Protestant pulpit. And that looks to me like the face of Islam here in the West. How would you respond?
Well, for example, I mention in the book that, and I cite an executive director of the Council on Arab Industrial Relations, CARA, that's often called, Council of American Islamic Relations, I'm sorry, I had it wrong, who indicates that mosques are not just places for social religious gathering, but also for political purposes. There you have it, from a top authority. I think we in this country are somewhat sometimes naive. We tend to judge Muslim mosques and the activities that go on in them in the light of Christian churches and synagogues, that they're purely religious and leave politics outside the door. This is not true, as this quotation in itself indicates. And I'm not just citing a man in the street. I'm citing an executive director of this organization. We also know, for example, that over 80% of the mosques in the United States, and there are over 1,200 of them, have been built and are supported by Wahhabism, basically the group that's behind the Al-Qaeda.
Let's take a break here, Dr. Schmidt, and we'll finish that thought, and we'll take more phone calls on the other side of the break. We have a free phone line waiting for your questions and your comments, 1-800-730-2727. When Christians gather together, they often pray for healing for those whom they know and love. But what is the role of Christian preaching in healing? What is the role of holy baptism in healing? What is the role of the Lord's Supper in healing? Do God's means of grace make any difference or hold any prospect for the human body? In our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Order Restored, A Biblical Interpretation of Health Medicine and Healing, you'll find answers to these questions. This book takes a uniquely Lutheran approach to both medicine and health. The book is $20.99 plus shipping and handling. Browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. Or order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Order Restored, by calling Concordia Publishing House. 1-800-325-3040.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again. I'm talking with Dr. Dean Wenthy, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Wenthy, how is Concordia Theological Seminary unique?
Our birthright, as it were, is the Christ's presence and his gifts. At the center of all we do here is our confession and worship of Christ and the Holy Trinity. So that more than being simply an academic institution, we're a worshiping institution. We gather as those baptized into Christ. We hear the living voice of Christ through the scriptures, and we attend his holy table where he gives us his very body and blood. And I think every other aspect of our life together in community, in academic work, in practical and outreach missions, flows from that time around font and altar, where we again hear the saving and truthful word of Christ, and then go forth to share it and to learn how to share it with the whole world. If you look over the Christian landscape, classic Lutheran theology is not frequently held up in its sacramental fullness and in its the beauty of scriptural witness. And that's our conviction, that by doing this, we may be unique, but we believe we're doing the very best we can for our fellow human beings in holding up Christ and Him crucified with scriptural clarity and with the sacramental gifts that He has bestowed upon His people.
So are you excited about the future of Concordia Theological Seminary?
In every way. I can't believe the blessings that we have been given. As we Lutherans say, not with any merit or worthiness on our part, but by God's grace, He continues to lead talented, dedicated men and women to give their lives to Him and to the truth of the gospel. And I'd like to invite any of your listeners to come and visit us, but more than visit, worship with us, be my guest for a campus tour, and see how our life revolves around this wonderful truth that the incarnate Christ has brought to our world.
That's Dr. Dean Winthy, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, call them toll-free at 1-877-287-4338 or visit them on the web at www.ctsfw.edu. Todd Wilkin here, talking with Dr. Dean Winthy, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Winthy, tell us about Concordia Theological Seminary as a worldwide outreach.
We have, at latest count, about 23 different countries represented on our campus. We have a full-time staff member teaching in Lithuania, another in Siberia, and then our resident faculty teaches regularly in Kenya, in Haiti. We just recently received an invitation to teach in Madagascar. So our commitment is to be a light on the hill and to broadcast the light of Christ into all the world.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit them on the web at www.ctsfw.edu. Next week on Issues, Etc., we're going to discuss healing with Pastor Mark Sell of Concordia Publishing House. Do modern-day faith healers, do they have a biblical understanding of either faith or healing? What can we learn today from the healing ministry of the healer himself, the great physician of body and soul, Jesus Christ, during his earthly ministry? We'll talk about all of that next week on Issues, Etc. with Pastor Mark Sell. Now, if you'd like to know what we'll be discussing for the weeks ahead on the program, just check out our website, issuesetc.org. While you're there at the website, be sure to read several articles on the subject of Islam. Issuesetc.org. Islam is the subject. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, author of the new book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. You can purchase this new book by calling toll-free 1-800-636-2470. That's the phone number for Regina Orthodox Press, 1-800-636-2470. Back to the phones. Philip is on the line. Philip calling from Maryland. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you, Dr. Schmidt, for your work on The Great Divide. I, too, would like to read your work. My question does pertain a divide. Would it be appropriate for a born-again Christian to attend a Muslim wedding while adhering to issues of taking off of shoes or refusal, conversely, to take off one's shoes in a Muslim environment? And if asked to make a statement, freely speak from a Christian perspective, considering the implications in such an environment?
Philip, those are two good questions. Now, we should note here that you should tell us, Dr. Schmidt, what the significance is of removing one's shoes, perhaps in a mosque or another Muslim environment at a function such as a wedding.
Yeah, well, it's because if it's a function in the mosque, it's considered to be holy ground, so to speak, and shoes would soil that holy ground, so you leave them at the door. That's typical Muslim practice. Even if you, as a tourist, go to a mosque, let's say in the Middle East, like in Turkey, I've been to several myself, you commonly have to leave your shoes at the door. Can a Christian do that? I think so. He's not compromising his belief in Jesus Christ. He is going there as a guest or as a person of curiosity, if he is a tourist, to see what a mosque looks like on the inside rather than having seen it in pictures, for example. I think as long as a Christian doesn't give any impression that he is or she is compromising his Christian convictions, you could do that.
Now, you mentioned their impressions. The caller also asked about if one was asked to give an explicit statement of the Christian faith in that context.
Well, then I would say even more so you ought to go. If you're permitted to do that, by all means. Because we, as Christians, never want to be taciturn or have our lips sealed when it comes to testifying to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Jesus told us himself, he who confesses me before men, him I will confess before the angels of God, and he who denies me before men, him I will deny before the angels of God. So there's just one passage, I think, that should encourage us to speak up and speak the gospel wherever the opportunity permits itself. And if you have that opportunity, God bless you and God be with you.
So should a Christian confronted with that kind of opportunity be mindful of what you mentioned in the first hour of our conversation, that of two factors. One, that Christians and Muslims do not worship the same God by any stretch of the imagination.
That's right.
And that many Muslims might want to give the impression or allow the impression to exist that we do worship the same God or that we have the same viewpoint toward Jesus Christ. Should both of those things be kept in mind? In other words, not to leave any impression with anyone.
Yes.
That we're dealing with the same God.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yes. I would preface my remarks, if you were permitted to make some, that you're not in any ways compromising, condoning what Muslims teach, that you're not in any way underscoring any of their teaching. Yes, I would very much make this clearly. For example, like I suppose St. Paul did on Mars Hill. He spoke to the pagan philosophers and the like and declared unto them the true God, Jesus Christ, and the resurrection and the like. One has to, yes, be careful that you don't make a compromise, that you're not misunderstood as seen as having engaged in a kind of syncretistic activity that, their religion is therefore as good as yours. I would make that very clear if you have the opportunity. The other thing I would mention, you're also not an official participant. You would be speaking as a guest on the side if they permitted you to do that. I'm not so sure that might happen, but maybe you might be fortunate in terms of it happening. But yes, make very sure that no compromise is given and that you're not in any way pulling the punch, if I may use that colloquial expression, in terms of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Make it very clear, as Peter said in Acts 4, neither is there salvation in any other, for there's no other name given under heaven among men whereby we must be saved, or what Jesus himself said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. And if you do it in the most loving but firm voice that you're capable of doing.
If you've been trying to call, but if you've been getting a busy signal, call right now, 1-800-730-2727. We have a few open phone lines, and we'll try and get you in, 1-800-730-2727. listening in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Dan is on the line. Dan, thanks for your patience.
Hello. Hello, Uncle Al.
Oh, my.
Question, plain and simple. How, when, and where did the Muslim faith start?
Thank you, Dan. Doctor, give us a brief history lesson.
It began with Muhammad, essentially in 622, when he took his hijra, the flight, to Mecca, from Mecca to Medina, basically to escape being further persecuted. He began preaching in about 613, 614, about 3 years after he was told by the angel Gabriel, supposedly, that he was a prophet sent from God. And for 3 years he was unsure. He thought that he was going insane, as he said to his first wife, Khadijah, and she convinced him that he was not going insane, but he was a prophet. She became, by the way, the first Muslim. Then he preached. He tried to gain followers peacefully from 613, 614 until about 622. Was not very successful. Even his group was exiled for a while into Abyssinia, modern Ethiopia. They came back, and then again they were persecuted. And so he took the flight, or the hijra, from Mecca to Medina in 622. And that is basically the beginning of the Muhammad or Muslim religion, which dates its calendar even from 622.
You mentioned the word there, and others have referred to, it's the old name for Islam or for the Muslim is Mohammedan.
Right.
Is that really a more accurate term?
Well, it might be, and I think yes, but today, of course, it doesn't go over very well with people who are Muslim, so I don't use it in the book. I was recently interviewed out of New York. A person who interviewed me consistently always used the word Mohammedism rather than Islam or Muslims. I don't use it because I'm not interested in antagonizing people in the Muslim circles. I'm interested in conveying what, in fact, the facts of history show, and to let them see it and read it in this country where they have the freedom to do so, whereas they don't in an Islamic country. So I personally, it might be more accurate, but I'm not going to make a point of whether one should use that instead. I think we would lose too much in the process.
So just suffice it to say that the average Muslim would consider the term Mohammedism or Mohammedan a derogatory term?
Yes, they do today.
Flo is calling from Maryland. Flo, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. Good evening. I was wondering, once I answer my question, could you put me on hold so I can hear it, because I can't hear you?
Be happy to do that. Be happy to do that.
Thank you. I was wondering, how would you preach the gospel of Jesus Christ to a Muslim? What's the best way to go about doing that? It's pretty hard.
You're quite right. There have been a few books recently published in that regard. You said, you gave the answer. It's quite hard. First of all, many of them suggest that you need to be a good neighbor. You need to be friendly. You should probably not engage in the conversation pointing out, first of all, the violent passages and the like that are found in the Quran. That probably would not get you off to a right start. Now, in my particular book, I am presenting a scholarly treatment and analysis, historical. And so, of course, I do cite those passages. My book, I hope that they will read and see what actually has been the history of Islam for 1,400 years, and that they might, also the result of that, take a closer look at Christianity. Whether they will or how many, I have no idea. But yes, it's a very tough time. It's always tough to present the gospel of Jesus Christ to people who are not Christians. But here, I think, even more so, because of the, particularly the tremendous amount of terrorism that has occurred in the last 3 years or so. So the average Muslim is probably more defensive than he or she was before. But at the same time, let's not forget, there are two major concepts in the Islamic religion. One is Dar al-Harb, which means the house or the field of war. That's all the non-Muslim world, the unbelievers, the infidels, versus the house al-Islam. And those two are in constant conflict with one another. And so when you talk to someone, try to present the gospel of Jesus Christ to them, you have to be aware of them. And that, one source or good literature to go to is to some people who have been missionaries among Muslims. They can also be helpful. But at the same time, the success usually has not been very great. But they have had success, and we have it even in this country. So whatever you can do, I have no simple answer. I wish I had them. If I did, I'd be pretty famous, I think.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Noted author and Christian apologist Gretchen Passantino on why you should support Issues, Etc.
Even though I live in Southern California and we've got several stations totally dedicated to what they call Christian programming, I make it a habit not to listen regularly to Christian radio. I turned on one of my local stations the other day and heard about an exorcist casting multiple demons out of a good Christian. Listened a little while ago and heard a whole panel of people on another Christian station talking about how the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem was going to usher in the second coming of Jesus Christ. You know, I just can't handle all that kind of stuff. But you know what I really like? The Christian programming that I like to listen to is Issues, Etc. No matter where I am in the country, if Issues, Etc. is on the program, I'm going to be listening. And the reason I like it is because we have solid, down-to-earth, biblical preaching and teaching, defending the faith from God's word instead of men's speculation. I know of no better ministry to support today than Issues, Etc.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, author of the new book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. A little bit of our email. This comes from Tammy in North Carolina. She writes this, Dr. Schmidt. As homeschoolers, we have learned that the tension between Christianity and Islam has been around for centuries, and that the young United States had a strong hand in stopping the early terrorists in the 1700s. There does not seem to be a lot of resources to continue our research in this history lesson. We were wondering if you had some books in mind that you would recommend, an often untapped source of history for the relationship between the West and Islam, Dr. Schmidt?
Well, off the top of my head, I can't give any. If you give me the lady's address after the interview here, I will communicate to her some sources that might be of help to her.
All right, we will do that. We'll give you her address at the conclusion of our conversation. Here's another one. This one's from Scott, and he writes, "We hear so much from our critics about Christian abuses related to the Crusades and other issues. But what does history teach us about Islam? Also, what part of their aggression and oppressive behavior is consistent with the life and teaching of Muhammad versus contradictory to it? Do you think, you mentioned before the break, that the terrorists are acting consistently with Islam. Could someone make a case, yes, they are acting consistent with Islam, but in the case of terrorists, they are going, even they are going too far." Dr. Montgomery. I'm sorry, Dr. Schmidt.
Yeah, it's okay. I forgive you. That even they, the terrorists, are going too far?
Yes. I mean, could a Muslim say, okay, yeah, we do have a violent religion, but terrorism, that's going too far. Even Muhammad would not have countenanced terrorism.
Well, I don't know. There may be some would say that, but if any Muslim said, yes, we have a violent religion, terrorists are going too far, I think that person would already have weakened his case by admitting that it's a violent religion. And if he's honest, he must admit it. Then I suppose he's talking about degrees of violence. Well, salami is still salami, no matter how thin you cut it.
Scott writes this, "What did Muhammad originally teach about the corruption or misunderstanding of the scriptures by Christians, and what is the modern view among Muslim scholars about the so-called corruption of the Christian scriptures?"
Well, as far as I know, they basically believe that the scriptures, the Old and New Testament, have been corrupted. They can't obviously provide any evidence for this. Ironically, there's even a contradiction in this regard. You know, so about 100 years after Muhammad died, in the 700s, about 750, they began to try and say that the Old Testament predicted the birth of Muhammad. And they used the same passage, for the most part, that Christians had been using long before Muhammad was born, that predicted the birth of Jesus Christ, going all the way back to the passages in Deuteronomy and the like. Now, there's a tremendous irony here. Now, if the Bible is corrupted, how come those passages aren't corrupted? Now, the reason they began saying that Muhammad's birth was predicted in the Old Testament, which were really the passages referring to Jesus Christ, was because there was a person by the name of John of Damascus, a monk, who lived among Muslims, argued once that they had no biblical authorities or predictions for Muhammad to have come on the scene, and so after that they resorted to using some of the same passages. Well, that in a sense indicates that they are ambivalent, if you might say, about the Bible, if they say it's corrupted, but at the same time, apparently these passages are not corrupted, and I've never seen anybody provide evidence why these passages would not be part of all of the corruption. In fact, the crucifixion is in part denied because the Bible was corrupted and never really happened that way, and so they denied the crucifixion, and that is in the Quran itself.
Dr. Schmidt, do we know whether or not Muhammad was aware of Orthodox Christianity? I have heard some state that what Muhammad had contact with by way of Christianity was in fact a heretical sect or sects of Christianity.
Quite right, and not only one. There were a number of sects circulating in his day and age. There were the Nestorians, who were condemned in 451 at the council Constantinople, or Chalcedon, if I can't remember my memory, anyhow, in 451, about the two natures of Christ, who basically believed Christ's nature was not divine. That was the Nestorians. There were the Jacobites, and there were other Christian sects that apparently gave bits and pieces of information to Muhammad, or that he picked up from circulating with them. There were also the Arians, for example, the people who denied the deity of Christ already in the early 4th century. The Council of Nicaea addressed that particular problem. They were circulating too. And in fact, Martin Luther saw the Islamic religion as a type of Arianism. In other words, where the deity of Christ is denied, and probably as a result of the people that circulated in a particular area of Saudi Arabia, as we would call it today. And this is what Muhammad picked up. Muhammad was not we don't even know if he could read or not. There's a lot of debate in the scholarly circles. Some say he could read, some say he could not. So even if he could read minimally, he undoubtedly never saw a scripture, the Old or New Testament, that he read from, but heard things hearsay, distorted as a result of heretical sects that still bore the name of Christian, and then made the conclusion from that. And, even to this day, we have a lot of people in Islamic circles that equate all of the Western society as Christian, even though not all of Western society is Christian. In fact, in many instances, in some European countries, the vast majority no longer are Christians. So there is that confusion too. But yes, definitely, he got a lot of false information from a lot of heretical sects that were quasi-Christian.
With only 1 minute, finally, Dr. Schmidt, how well does the average Muslim know his own religion, the Quran, the Hadith, and could this, if this is ignorance, could this ignorance account for what you have called the Great Divide?
Yes, I think a great deal of it. I imagine they are no better informed than our Christians about the Bible. Maybe less so. I have no evidence. I've never seen any research on that particular question. But, the Quran is not an easy book to read. In fact, very difficult to read. Now then, in addition to the Quran, you have about 4,500 pages of the Hadith. I'm sure they're not read because people tend not to read. We know that very few Christians read the Bible. They can't even tell you the four Gospels. The vast majority can't tell you the four Gospels of the New Testament, much less what they contain. So I believe ignorance is a great deal of it. Oh, yes, Muslims are supposed to read the Quran. So are Christians supposed to read the Quran. I think therein lies much of the answer. It's ignorance. Ignorance of their own work, listening to what the media tell them in terms of being peaceful, when history of 1400 years clearly, distinctly denies that it has been a peaceful religion. It never was for 1400 years. We would simply have to hide our head in the sand to say that that's the case. And ultimately to our own detriment. To say this is obviously, as a rule, not very welcome news, as one of our callers indicated. But the truth is there, and the truth sometimes is, well, not well received.
If you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of the Next Issues Etc. Journal, or if you'd like to help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Dr. Schmidt, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Yeah, and I might mention one more time, they can click into my name on Amazon.com and the book will appear and they can get it, as you indicated earlier. I think Amazon.com sells it for $14.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville. The book he mentioned, The Great Divide, he has authored it. It's brand new. The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Go to Amazon.com or call 1-800-636-2470, 1-800-636-2470. If we can do anything to alleviate, to clear up the ignorance that exists on both sides, that is the task. You see, the Christian always is concerned about handling, and rightly handling, the truth. Not only the truth of God's Word, but all truth. Even the truth about Islam. We rightly handle it. Nothing will be accomplished by perpetuating myths or wishful thinking when it comes to Islam. We have to look at the thing for what it really, truly is. And then we need to be clear, as and speaking the truth in love, as clear as we possibly can be to both the Christian and to the Muslim about the true nature of the Muslim religion. Lest, as Dr. Schmidt has pointed out, lest we continue to believe that somehow we are dealing with a religion that leads to the same God as Christianity? No.